On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Avaya files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Lovabit is back. AMD's got 32 cores for you. And Splunk is here to tell you everything you need to know about rugged DevOps. Twyet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twyet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 223, recorded January 20th, 2017, Rugged DevOps with Splunk. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. To learn more about GoCD, visit gocd.io/twit for a free download. And by Audible. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. This is a big job. For that, I'm going to need a little help from my friend, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it's so good to see you and at home. This is like a dream come true to the Twyet Riot. How are you, my friend?
Padre, I'm doing very, very well. It is great to be here in the swamp this week. And at the end of the show, I've got some news to share with the Twyet Riot and everyone out there. So it's a great week to be here on Twyet.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is what we call a tease. Now, a man who isn't going to tease us because he lays all his cards on the table at the very beginning of every show is Mr. Lou Maresca from Microsoft. Lou, I'm noticing some new digs here. What's going on?
Yeah, it's a little bit my new office, and I got a nice window, and it looks like I'm wearing the right shirt for the video today and everything. I'm doing well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll get back to that as well. But gentlemen, we've got a fun packed show today. We've got some friends from Splunk. You may remember Splunk. They've been a darling of the technology sector. If you've ever wanted to do any sort of data analytics, log analytics, if you've ever had a project where you've had to deal with huge data sets, Splunk is one of the avowed masters. And we're going to be bringing two of their best onto the show to, well, unleash some of the secrets of the Splunkers. But before that, we got to jump straight in to the blips. This one's a little on the sad side. Yesterday afternoon, networking and UC provider Avaya filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in order to reorganize its debt and unburden itself in preparation for a move away from hardware sales to a software and services focus. The Silicon Valley stalwart, which started life as the Lucent Enterprise Communications Group until it was spun off in 2000, has been increasingly in a struggle to service debt from an $8-plus billion buyout in 2007 when Avaya was almost exclusively a hardware vendor. The company made $756 million in the year ending this past September on $3.7 billion in revenue. However, with several one-time charges, mainly for the servicing of that debt, the fiscal year ended with a $262 million loss. Just do the math on that. Avaya is in the process of restructuring its debt to get breathing room that it needs to complete the transition to software-defined and IoT networking services.
According to IBM, AI needs more than just technology. Artificial intelligence on its own isn't enough to compete. Companies need industry-specific solutions to business problems. That somewhat surprising statement comes to us from Martin Schroeder, IBM's Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, on the company's most recent quarterly earnings call. In response, IBM is building data sets for Watson to serve specific industries, including healthcare and finance. Schroeder says IBM also sees blockchain as strategic to serving enterprises using cloud, and IBM is building more complete, industry-specific blockchain platforms. Demand for cognitive computing is appearing to be driving the growth for IBM, And cloud giants, including IBM, Amazon Web Services, Microsoft, and Google, are all aggressively investing in AI to drive their own competitive advantage.
Remember Edward Snowden? You know, the guy who did a bit of whistleblowing over the years against the NSA. Well, he used to use email for most of it, and it was pretty secure. Some say he's a hero, a man behind the email system, Ladar Levinson, who ran LavaBit, an encrypted email service. When Levinson was approached by the government to actually give up his SSL cert encryption keys so that he could actually decode Snowden's passwords and other passwords, Levinson shut the service down rather than giving it up. Well, it's back. LavaBit has relaunched today, and Levinson says they have a new architecture that makes it even more secure. LavaBit can no longer hand over the keys to the kingdom because it uses a key that's now stored in hardware security module. Now, we talked about Intel SGX before, if you remember, which is a tamper-resistant device that provides a secure enclave in the hardware for storing keys and performing sensitive functions like encryption, decryption. Once the service is back up in its entirety, all those emails and accounts that were lost before when they shut down we'll be back. Maybe now I can get my grandmother's secret recipe for cookies from the server and make my millions.
No cookies for you, especially if you're running Hadoop or CouchDB. Now, just a week ago, administrators of MongoDB databases and Elasticsearch clusters panicked as their deployments were systematically targeted and destroyed with their data held for ransom. Now it seems that Hadoop and CouchDB admins are in the same crosshairs. Victor Givers and Niall Merrigan, security researchers who have been monitoring the MongoDB and Elasticsearch attacks, are now seeing similar activity in Hadoop and CouchDB deployments. As in last week's exploits, the attackers have been preying on poorly configured databases with turnkey attack toolkits. As of yesterday noon, the researchers had documented 126 instances of Hadoop installations being deleted, which is a far cry from the 34,000 MondoDB and 4,600 Elasticsearch instances. But last week's attacks also started slow and accelerated as more attackers switched their aim. One big note of importance is the fact that unlike last week's attacks, which typically demanded a 500 Bitcoin ransom for the data, the Hadoop deletion seemed to be more vandalism than extortion, with a few attackers leaving notes to admins telling them to do, quote, a better job of securing their databases in the future, unquote.
Oracle is building a deeper API with Apiary. Oracle is continuing to build out its cloud computing capabilities with the acquisition of Apiary, a startup that specializes in designing, governing, testing, and documenting cloud APIs. When it comes to cloud APIs, Oracle already provides several pieces of the puzzle, including security and analytics. What Apiary adds to the mix are the front and customer-facing APIs, including offerings that provide design and governance for developers. While it's a young company, Apiary already has some significant customers as part of its rosters, customers that include Bloomberg, Blue Cross Blue Shield, GoPro, and NBC Universal. In some of the large enterprises Apiary supports, there can be hundreds of different applications that all need to talk to one another, as well as the interaction with customers who want to use a particular service. For its part, Oracle has been busy building out its cloud capabilities as it looks to compete against the likes of Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, Google, IBM, and others.
So we all know that the top challenge for renewable energy is storing the excess energy efficiently. And the most abundance of this energy, obviously, is solar energy. This has kind of sparked the need for most efficient, more efficient solar thermal energy systems that can store concentrated heat from the sun. Instead of using a type of battery, researchers have come up with a way to use molten silicon to store 10 times more energy than existing storage options. The team for the University of Polytech of Madrid could be the winner here, so far. At least, because silicon is the world's most abundant and cheapest element, second only to oxygen. I wish them success because it's definitely a step in a much brighter and sunshiny future.
In a world dominated by quad-core CPUs, AMD rightly thought they needed something special to potentially entice system makers to take a dive into their waters. And so they did, by announcing Naples, a 32-core, 64-thread, single-socket server CPU. Naples builds on the Zen core that AMD introduced at CES, promising a 40% increase in instructions per clock cycle while offering more cores per chip than all but Intel supercomputing Xeon Phi. There isn't much demand expected for a 64-core CPU, but there is demand for single-socket solutions rather than the dual, quad, and octo-socket approach usually used by Intel-based enterprise servers. AMD will be releasing versions of Naples with fewer cores, and they're pinning their hopes for the server market on the x86 architecture after a disastrous series of decisions squandered their 2003 Opteron lead in the server market till they abandoned it in 2013 for ARM. That does it for the Blips. Next up, we're going to be going into the Bytes, but first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And hey, admins, get a little closer because I got to tell you something. Now, I get it. Deployments are hard, especially in the day of deployment cycles that run in days rather than months or years. Now, integrations still need to happen even while those deployments are live and going at full tilt. Now, downtime simply isn't an option, but neither is an untested integration in a patchwork deployment. So what do you do? Well, thankfully, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD. It's an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks that can soothe your deployment headaches. GoCD gives you the ability to model complex workflows across multiple teams with comprehensive pipeline modeling. With GoCD, you can model both parallel and sequential execution, so you can configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment. What does that all mean? Well, in a word, visibility. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. You get a comprehensive picture of deployments across your organization so that you can be agile in your response and see issues before they become problems. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. It can perform tests written in most languages or frameworks with detailed logging, telling you exactly which change set and on which platform a test started breaking. All of this adds up to saying goodbye to your deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. Now, if you are worried about your deployments, if you have integrations that are going to be a challenge, you owe it to yourself to try GoCD. GoCD is the best continuous integration and deployment tool that you've probably never heard of. To learn more about GoCD and for a free download, visit gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial supported enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We've got something, well, I think this is a story we're going to see more and more of, crossing the boundary between enterprise security and personal health. You see, St. Jude, they did a medical patch and then revealed their pacemaker's vulnerability. The Homeland Security Department warned Tuesday about an attack that they found. It was an unusual cybersecurity flaw for one particular manufacturer's implantable heart devices. Now, these heart devices were used by St. Jude Medical. It said that these could allow hackers to remotely take control of a person's defibrillator or pacemaker. Now, if that is not terrifying enough, there was further information on the security flaw. You see, it was identified by a few researchers at MedSec Holding months ago. So this is not a new report. This is something that's been sitting around, something that attackers could exploit or could start researching on their own. It was only formally made public after the manufacturer, that's St. Jude Medical, made a software repair available this past Monday. Oh, Curtis, okay, let's stop there because there's a lot to unpack already. Let's take this on the surface. We've got a medtech manufacturer with a flaw that can allow for remote control of a life-saving device. Does it really get a lot worse than this? I mean, this is like the absolute nightmare of the Internet of Things.
It is indeed. And, you know, let's say now that the allowing remote control isn't in itself the problem. There are all kinds of implantable medical devices that allow for remote manipulation of how they operate. Pacemakers are one. There are things that deal with defibrillation, all kinds of sensors. There are artificial adjuncts to organs. And this is going to get more prevalent because we know that we're moving forward in artificial organs. We recently had FDA approval, for example, for what amounts to an artificial pancreas. That's a real-time glucose monitor and insulin pump that are deeply interconnected. And that use the cloud for some of their command and control. So I think what this really points out is the critical nature of making sure that the authentication of the devices is ironclad, and that the security of the back-end systems and their inter-process communications are absolutely rock solid. Now, I have not read this particular research report, so I don't know where the flaw lived, but it's obvious that somewhere in the systems that allow for the normal functioning of this device, there was a hole. And there are going to be more opportunities for things like this, more opportunities for dire consequences. And we've got to see manufacturers getting it right before the first device is implanted. I mean, let's face it, this was one of those things that could give a whole new meaning to the phrase ransomware.
Or denial of service attack on a heart. Okay, Lou, let me go over to you, because I don't want to fud this up too much. It's very easy to look at this and panic and say the sky is falling. We've heard stuff like this before. I think what makes this scary, the dimension, is the fact that this is a device inside someone's body. So, I mean, this could literally be a life or death issue. But it only works when you're at home, because the way that these pacemaker systems work is when you're at home, you're in range of your transmitter, which can transmit data, logged data, back to your doctor. And the idea is a sound one. If your doctor has more of a picture of how your heart is doing throughout the day rather than just a snapshot when you're connected to the machine, then he can make better decisions about your course of treatment. So in that sense, you know, there's not a huge window for someone to attack. And you'd have to know someone has a pacemaker. You'd have to go after the machine that's making the link between the pacemaker and the doctor's computer. And then you'd also have to have just the motivation to do something malicious, which I'm sure it's out there, but I don't think most of us are going to shut off someone's pacemaker just for the lulz. However, there is a phenomenon here that I think we need to talk about, because it does address a very Silicon Valley-centric idea, and that is push out product first, get the features out, and then we'll fix it. This has been a rallying cry against the Internet of Things for the past 3 years, which is we can't do that anymore, folks, because it's not like these devices are luxuries. We're starting to connect things to networks that are absolutely vital for life as we know it, and literally in this particular case. What do we have to do? And I know we've asked this question before. What do we have to do as people in IT to ingrain upon the people that we work with that security can no longer be an afterthought? It's got to be something that goes on in the alpha of a product, not fixed after release.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a very loaded question, but I'll try to get to the fundamentals. I think, you know, what we do here is, you know, anything that has to do with personal information, you know, especially medical information, it needs to be secured, it needs to be isolated away in some kind of a storage location that can be encrypted and have and go with protocol and compliance that they have for those, that type of data. Storing it on your local hard drive or even on a device is probably not a good idea. I mean, especially since, you know, people can reverse these protocols and, you know, for devices, even wireless protocols, as well as, you know, be able to attack and different areas of networks that those devices are connected to. So, you know, putting it out in these areas, these companies that offer this type of storage, or even the type of storage that we're looking for that can encrypt and follow these compliant rules, you know, they're made to do that, and it's more secure. You can keep an eye closer on your data, you know, knowing that you have secure storage backing it up. And I think that that's a good start. You know, I've seen computer systems, and we don't do it, but I know computer systems, like people store social security numbers directly in the database without encrypting them, or maybe they will encrypt them, but they store the encryption key on the server, and somebody who can attack that server will get the encryption and can decode all the database data. So I think that these types of things, you just have to know what you're doing, and sometimes you just don't. And putting your efforts into a place that does, that has follows all the rules, it's, you know, government backed or something like that, you'll know that they'll have what you need there. And I think that that's a good start, is you going through all your data and making sure it's not identifiable for customers, it's not personal, it's you know, it's more of just data around usage and so on and so forth, and you're not storing it in an unsecure location. And once you start there, you can kind of start to build additional layers of security on top of it.
Actually, that's a great point, because that's an oft-forgotten part of security, which is if you truly make the data anonymous, if you make it unaffiliatable with a particular identity, then that kind of stops a lot of attacks in their tracks. I mean, if that data doesn't exist to make that connection, then it's less useful as an attack. But Curtis, I just thought this actually is a weird issue, because when you start thinking about forcing manufacturers to be open and honest about vulnerabilities, especially in devices that could affect the lives of individuals, we don't know where this falls. I mean, this is an exploit that has existed for months and months and months, and the manufacturer held off on releasing any information until they had a patch. And furthermore, they said that they're going to patch these gradually over the next few months. So it could be up to half a year or a year before all of these devices no longer suffer from this exploit. Who's responsible for it? This is one of those convergences of technology. Partially it falls under the FDA. Partially it falls under the FCC. Partially it's going to fall under the Department of Homeland Security. When you start looking at these integrations of technology with different sectors of life, someone at some point has to be responsible for saying, I'm the guy who holds people's feet to the fire. But we don't know who that is yet.
You know, that's very true, because this is one of those cases where you have a device that, as you point out, uses technology that in discrete chunks would be governed by many different regulatory agencies. Now, I tend to think that because of the nature of this particular device, the primary regulating body really ought to be the FDA, because they are very stringent with good reason, and we're seeing why. You know, when you think about the implications of a technology failure, whether it's through simple mechanical failure or through malicious activity, the FDA is used to dealing with some very harsh consequences. As I said, this is going to be one of those things that gets more difficult. And, you know, I think it's worth saying that one of the things that we don't know about is whether over the coming years we're going to see a different regulatory posture from government agencies than we've seen in the past few years. There are a lot of things that are unknown right now, and frankly, all of those unknowns put together give me, in aggregate, another great reason to be grateful that I don't have one of these devices sitting in my chest.
Right. As a final note, before we have to move on, because we are running out of time, it's the fact that this story, this exact same story, has kind of broken before. A medical manufacturer, St. Jude, was accused of this back in August, I believe. And at that point, it was debunked. But the problem with a story like this, and I think this gets to the heart of what we're talking about, is there are so few regulations and so few guidelines on what manufacturers do with potential vulnerabilities that it makes it far too easy for us to either not pay attention to a story that's important or to pay attention to a story that's untrue. I'm not okay with that. I'm just not okay with that. But let's move on. All right. So this one, okay, let's get more of an upbeat thing. This is a call to arms for all those admins out there who have maybe been a little bit lazy about upgrading and patching their Bind servers. Now, as we all know, Bind is the most popular internet DNS server. Like all DNS servers, it's going to translate human-readable domain names like ZDNet, CNET, Fox, whatever it's going to be, into IP addresses. Now, it's also used in almost all Linux and Unix-based servers. It is the de facto service of choice. But unfortunately, we also know that it's incredibly vulnerable right now, and a lot of people have not done their patching. Now, until you patch it, you are running Bind with three security holes, well-known security holes, any one of which can be used to use your server to create a DDoS. These are going to be CVE. That's 2016-9131, CVE-2016-9147, and CVE-2016-9444. That's right. So, of course, these all happened last year. These were all disclosed. We've actually talked about these on Twiit, and yet we've got security researchers who are scanning the net and finding that most, not just some, but most instances of Bind that are running in Linux and Unix environments are still running the vulnerable versions of Bind. Now, the only good news about this is that most of those DNS servers are running in recursive mode, and though that vulnerability is not really going to affect us all that much. And because in recursive mode, the bind server tries to work out the address by querying upstream, and as long as your authoritative DNS server is patched, you're probably going to be okay. Now, Curtis, I'm going to throw this over to you because this is one of those geek-heavy stories where you just kind of want to nudge people and say, hey, you know, I know it's a pain. I know you're going to have to recompile a couple of things. It's probably not the easiest thing for you to do, but this is actually important. We've heard this call before to make sure that you're patched, and yet most of us become very patch-wary. How do you work past the exploit fatigue that we typically have in IT?
That's a great question, and it's not one with an easy answer, because especially when you get into infrastructure pieces, most of these are on a very, very slow refresh cycle and a very, very slow patch cycle. There are all kinds of infrastructure pieces where the core software is patched once a year, perhaps. If that, because of all the dependencies and because of all the things that have to be put into a slowdown or even non-operative mode while the patch takes effect. It's one of those areas where what we have are multiple refresh cycles, multiple patch cycles, and we get used to the speed of one and think that it should be applying to everything, but it still isn't. You know, we're not that far removed from a time. I know with network infrastructure pieces where there were a lot of core routers that were patched once every 2 to 3 years. Now we look at that and say, well, you would have to be stupid not to patch more than that. But again, think about all the users, all of the systems, all the applications, all the processes that depend on these core pieces of the infrastructure. I think what we have here are some cases, as these vulnerabilities build up, we have the case being made for more frequent updates to key infrastructure pieces. But we still have a lot of folks and a lot of IT shops where the real strategy is just to pray that no one finds the vulnerability in the months and months that pass between scheduled updates.
I think I just got a suggestion for my next Priest t-shirt. It's going to say pray, .. on the back. That no one finds your vulnerabilities. I think this would sell. I think this could be a Twitch shirt. All right, but seriously, I'm going to go off on a tangent here. And Lou, I'm sorry if this takes you someplace where you don't want to go. But this is a very, very good example of this tension we have between the whole patch your stuff mentality of, you know, demanding that admins do it and just relying on them and their goodwill and their desire to be a good internet citizen versus the other approach, which some software giant has taken, which is we're just going to patch it for you. No, we're not even giving you that choice, which has raised a lot of ire. I'm among them. I hate that idea. I do believe that, look, I will patch things when I know I have time to patch them, when my systems aren't being used for something important. But then, you know, you can make cases for both. You can say, look, we should wait for people to patch because they know when it's time to patch. But you can also say, but people don't do that. That's not human nature. Where do you fall in this? I mean, should these patches be just automatic because they affect the entire internet? Or do we still have to say, yes, I want you to patch, but ultimately I leave that decision up to you?
I think there's different layers, right? Because I think, you know, in this case, like you were saying, this is a DNS system that a good majority of the web depends on in order to get to the right location. And I think that in order for that to be secure and for people to trust the internet, they should continue to keep themselves up to date. It should be their responsibility to do that. So whether it's automatic or not, they should stay up to date no matter what. And that's, it goes along with, I mean, the mentality, I mean, I don't know where they're coming from a Microsoft perspective, why they're forcing this, but it kind of makes sense in a way because, you know, these people are moving to these cloud services and they need to be able to trust these services to host their systems as well as their data. And they need to know that it's going to be secure. And they need to know that And the only way for the systems to stay secure is if they have this continuous deployment of updates, and not only from virus protection to, you know, to exploits to all these things. And in order for them to make sure that they stay secure, they need to be up to date 100% all the time, even before those exploits even become public. And I think this is something that especially a system like DNS should be doing as well. The same standards should be followed across the board. Now, where we're talking home machines, now, again, should you be storing, you know, secured, really secure data on your home machines? Probably not. But if you are, you know, having a patch is always a good thing. You know, people always ask me, how do I secure my system better? Well, there's always those rules. Don't be an admin. Don't be, you know, put your data on a separate drive, encrypt it, these kinds of things. But, you know, normal users don't know this. So that's why I think a giant like Microsoft, a giant like Apple, they tend to force these. Even Apple does it today. They have this new checkbox. Right. You can do automatic updates. You don't even know what's happening anymore, even on OS X. Now, it's not as in-your-face and as abundant as Windows, but, you know, they do it. And I think that the reason why they're moving to this is a Windows as a service or an operating system as a service is to just make sure you don't get yourself into trouble, because you don't really know you are in trouble. And I think that's where they're coming from. And I kind of agree with that model, especially when I have parents who don't necessarily know the best about their computers.
You know, I had a sit down with a Microsoft person, a good friend from way, way back when I was at CES in Vegas this 2 weeks ago. And we talked about this, and he had a very interesting take. He's like me. He hates it when his computer just decides to update, even if it's in work hours, because evidently there are some patches that are so important that they just happen. But then he said something else. He goes, I understand, though, the need to do that, because we've got organizations that have weaponized ignorance. And I asked him what that meant. He said, well, think about it. He said, we now have a situation in which you've got a toolkit. Your toolkit is your computer. It's your network. It's your system. And there are people who have figured out how to use your toolkit to do nefarious things. He saw it as akin to your right to have guns. You can have guns. That's your given right as a United States citizen. But if you leave your guns in the trunk of your car and you leave your car unlocked with the trunk open, then you're responsible for that. And they're trying to keep that from happening. They're trying to make sure the car is always locked. It wasn't a great analogy, but I understood where he was coming from, which is maybe it's time for us to start relooking at what it means to be a good internet citizen. And that's not just for admins, that's for end users as well, because as we've often used as a mantra here on Twiat, if you own the edge, you can destroy the core. All right, let's go ahead and move on, folks. We've got two very special people from Splunk. We've got Manzi Mirza. He's the head of cyber research, or as I like to call it, the cyber at Splunk. And we've got Andy Mann. He's the chief technology advocate from Splunk. They're going to be coming here to tell you all about how their services might help you with whatever data you're analyzing. But first, let's take a moment to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Audible. It's a leading provider of audiobooks across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. I have been using Audible for years. I do a lot of driving. In fact, I love driving. This is one of the reasons why I enjoyed moving back to California after living on the East Coast for so long, because I've got long drives. I love the drive from San Francisco to Las Vegas, even though it might take me 8 hours. I have no problem driving 16 hours a day, because it means that I get a little time with myself. And what do I like to do when I've got that time with myself? I like to read. Specifically, I like to read with my earballs with Audible. Oh, recently, I've gone back through my old catalog of favorites. I'm listening to The Wind-Up Girl. Of course, I'm listening to The Martian, even though I've listened to The Martian like 50 times. Coming back from CES, however, my choice, and I'm so glad I started this up, because I read the book, but I never listened to the audiobook, was Ready Player One. Now, Ready Player One is narrated by none other than Will. That's right, Will the Wheaton. And I got to tell you, it's phenomenal to hear it in the voice of someone who I know from my childhood, I know from my sci-fi geekdom. It was magical. And I was entranced. I had one of those driveway moments, because I took the long way around and I was almost at the end of the book when I got back to my house in San Francisco. I actually sat in my driveway for 30 minutes just to finish it, because I was so comfortable. Folks, this is the kind of mindset that Audible is going to drop you into. It's going to make you remember that these aren't just books. These aren't just words and not just pages. It's an entire world ready for you to dive into. Now, if you like reading as much as I do, I know you're going to love Audible. For listeners of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you may consider downloading is Ready Player One. Give it a try. Tell me if you don't like it. And tell me if it doesn't bring back the 80s, for those of you who are alive in the 80s. To download this audiobook for free, or another one of your choice, go to audible.com/enterprise. That's audible.com/enterprise. Offer good in the United States and Canada. This applies to all of Audible's offers through TWIT. And we thank Audible for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to my favorite part of the show. That's when we bring in some experts to help out, help us suss out the most important topics in the world of the enterprise. Now, in studio, we've got Mr. Andy Mann. He's the Chief Technology Advocate for Splunk. Andy, thank you very much for coming all the way up.
Oh, Padre, it's absolutely my pleasure.
Now, you are not from California.
No, this is my Colorado accent. I actually am based in Boulder, Colorado. You can probably tell them, you can probably hear the mountains.
I hear it. Yeah. It's the mountain accent.
Yeah, originally from Sydney, Australia, of course, but currently residing in Colorado.
And you've been with Splunk for how long?
Just over 18 months.
Oh, fantastic. You're going to love it. I've been dealing with the Splunkers for such a long time, going back to my time with Wildman.
Of course,
everyone knows him. But also joining us over the Skypes, because you know Splunk's a pretty big company and they're everywhere, is Manzi Mirza. He's the head of the cyber research over at Splunk. Manzi, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Padre. It's great to be here. And you know, as even though Andy Mann and I live in the same time zone and the same mountain range, we never get to be together. So really appreciate you creating the opportunity for the two of us to be in the same room at the same time.
Well, gentlemen, that's what we're known for. TWIT TV, we bring people together. That's totally not a slogan, but okay. But we're going to go with that anyways. So, Manzi, you've got an interesting history. You've got over 15 years of tactical and cybersecurity research experience. Can you tell us a little bit about how that brought you into Splunk and what it is that you do over there?
So I grew up, like many of us, working in IT, and that sort of worked its way into security, into the security space for me, and then started slowly evolving into not just being a defender, but also trying to do red team activities and so on. And then as I learned more and more, learned from my mentors and the community, then started to actually do tools development, hardware tools and software tools, you know. And then over time, I realized that the government organizations that I used to work for, that I could do a lot of good things there, but with Splunk, it's really more about the community and more about impacting a much broader scope within the world, if you will. So it's almost, for me, it's very much driven out of a passion and out of perhaps naively this sense of wanting to make a difference. And that's what attracted me to Splunk. And I've been here since 5.5 years. And when I joined, we were less than 200. Now we're over 2,500. And thanks to all the Splunk customers and all the Splunk users to be in this amazing, humbling position, which is such a privilege.
Now, you are an excellent cybersecurity researcher, and you've got so much experience with the enterprise, with startups. You've done consulting. You've done visionary work. You've two very different people, and you've ended up at the same company, which is going to make our audience ask, what exactly is Splunk? We've had you on a few times. We've shown off some of your solutions, but do either of you have a really good way to describe what Splunk is and what Splunk does, other than saying Splunk's doing incredibly well, Splunk's very popular, and Splunk offers some of the best solutions that we've seen here on TWiET?
I would grab that and just say that Splunk is a platform for machine data. So we take all the machine data you get, servers, switches, mobile devices, applications. We collect all that data, we analyze it, we aggregate it, and we provide ways for you to search and make meaning from it. That's the simplest way to understand what Splunk does. So whether that meaning is understanding performance and availability of applications and systems, whether it is understanding penetrations, other security attacks, being able to do diagnostics, being able to do forensics on all of that machine data. It gives you the real insight for lots of people throughout the enterprise to be able to understand what does all that data mean. Yeah.
There's going to be people in our audience who are saying, wait a minute, this is just big data. But the thing is, remember, Splunk was doing this before big data even was known as big data. There was a time at Interop where we collected all these logs, terabytes of logs, for a 1 week show, and then we would throw them away because no one ever knew what to do with the logs. I mean, maybe you would shuffle through them if there was a major problem, but it wasn't as if we were collecting them to analyze them. We were just collecting them because it was a good idea to collect them. Splunk, when we brought Splunk in, And they showed us what we could do with drilling down on individual devices or drilling down on individual problems. That really made an impact. In fact, Chebert became one of the biggest evangelists for Splunk because he had been in this industry for so long, he had never seen anything that could do that. That's how we know. But we didn't come here to reminisce about interop or to talk about why Splunk is the greatest. We're here because of your expertise with DevOps. Everyone's heard of DevOps, but let's start really simple. Andy, maybe could you explain what do we mean when we say DevOps?
Sure. I tend to take a canonical definition of it. It's a method of connecting development and operations people together so that they can communicate, collaborate, and integrate to deliver better software faster.
Got it. Okay. And Manzi, taking that definition, now, so we know what DevOps is. So hopefully the people in the audience go, okay, yeah. I was always afraid to ask what DevOps was because I didn't want to sound stupid, but that's perfect. That's exactly what DevOps does. But that's not all that DevOps does anymore because, and this ties into the discussion that we were having earlier in the show, DevOps has come to mean more than just trying to fit together pieces to get out some sort of product. There's now a certain level of security and awareness about security that fits into DevOps. How has DevOps changed over, I'd say, even the last 18 months?
I'd like to render this back to some of our customers at Splunk. And Andy mentioned this, you know, when you ask initially, what does Splunk do? We're all used to using everything from mobile devices, calling a car, making a banking transaction and ordering pizza while we're crossing a street because we can do that now. So from that perspective, now when you look at DevOps and when you look at security in general, now it's a much different landscape where all of those activities have security implications. So the line now between people doing development work or people doing security work, people doing operational work, all those lines are completely blurred. So that's where I see where there is this tremendous intersection of where people like, you know, the viewers on the show right now, we're all constantly working towards enabling, whether it's our customers or our businesses, to do these kinds of things. And it has implications. And we can no longer use the old style tactics of it is going to take 6 months or 9 months or 2 years to roll something out or try a new product. It has to happen fast. It has to happen now. And it has to happen responsibly. And it has to happen securely. And I think that's why, you know, to go back to your original question, Padre, I mean, that's why a person like Andy Mann and somebody like me from the security side of the world, we belong at the same table for that reason, because we live in a different world now.
Right. Exactly. And that's what I love about it. I mean, you are gathering the right team members. I've seen several startups with incredibly good engineers that maybe don't understand the business side or maybe don't understand the security side. And I've seen teams build up with great security professionals that maybe don't really know how to design UI. You need everybody because of the changing nature of DevOps. And Manzi, let me go back to you about this. We've heard about DevOps. We've heard about DevSecOps. There's a new term that I've heard thrown around, which is rugged DevOps. How has that changed? You touched on it a little bit, but give me an example of what DevOps used to look like and what rugged DevOps looks like now.
So I always like to go back to people in the real world doing real things rather than a person from a product company talking about the definitions of something. And I will use the example of folks like Shazam or folks like SAP SuccessFactors. And what they're doing is they're constantly evolving the products and services that they offer to their customers. And they do that in a rapid way, not just from the perspective of someone's going to engineer something. It's about engineering, it's about testing, and then it's about deployment and getting that, whatever that new thing or that more robust service or that new feature and or that ease of use in the hands of the user of the product or of the service. And I think that's really what DevOps has historically been about. And then in this case, you know, the security community is starting to learn from that to say, hey, look, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here. And it used to be around security automation where we'd say, you know, wouldn't it be cool if I can automatically do some portion of response during the course of an incident? So, or I could kick off a thread and I can automatically do packet capture, for example, for something. And that automation is interesting. But what if it could be part of a broader cycle? What if automation and what if this intertwining of the operational world, whether it's a router or a firewall, And the security world, whether it's forensics or incident investigation, or whether it's a development world of delivering some new package or content to the customer, what if we can all sort of tie that stuff together for ourselves? And I think that's where this notion of whether you apply the label of rugged DevOps or whether you apply the label of DevSecOps, I think as a grassroots sort of coming together of people in different teams who used to be in these silos, whether, you know, we used to say things like, you know, oh, that guy's in IT or that guy's in security or that guy is a developer. Like, what do they know about something? But my experience is that, you know, when something really bad happens in an organization, whether it's an IT related problem or an operations related problem, or if it's a development or engineering or a security problem, we really need to come together and have many, many examples of how people come together. And as it started to happen more and more in this complex environment, I gave you the example of this digital transformation of crossing the street and ordering pizza and making a banking transaction. As that happens more and more, we're relying on each other more and more, regardless of what our area of expertise are. And that's where we can have a common language and we can have integrations, and more organizations are starting to do that at a grassroots level because it's a necessity.
All right. Let's back this up, because Monza, you said exactly the things that we needed you to say, you know, breaking down silos, actually having cooperation across teams. This is all good, but then there's going to be people who are watching this and people in the chat room who are saying, I like what you're saying, but I don't know how to do that. How do I break down the silos? How do I make sure that security is part of the initial testing? How do I make sure that we have pen testing on the agenda for the ops team? I want to throw this over to you, Andy, because you know, this is more of a strategy issue. This, you know, the engineers will do their thing when you tell them what to do, but they need an executive who actually understands why there needs to be an interaction between the security team and DevOps, and why compliance testing has to be in that first layer that can't come after the product has been mostly finished. How do you change culture within a company that's going to be dealing with huge data sets, that is looking at DevOps that could affect a lot of different companies, a lot of different individuals? How do you ingrain in them that that the silos need to be broken down, and then actually explain to them how they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to start with, I think you touched on something really important there, which is DevOps is about culture. And it's about people. But culture is an output, not an input, right? It's a result of what you do. You can't just go and say, we need a DevOps culture. We need to work together. You need to do stuff to make that happen.
Right.
So there's two ways, bottom up. And this is where DevOps started. It started with a bunch of developers and operators who wanted to do the right thing, who wanted to get better at what they did, who wanted to make each other's lives not suck. And so they got together and they worked out how to do that and how to work together. The other way is, especially in a larger enterprise, like you say, you've got silos, you've got departments. They might be different locations. They might be even different countries, development in one country, operations somewhere else. And so those people have to get together. The executive, like you say, have to push that down. Now, you can start in a lot of ways. You can start with a DevOps team. Right. And that's a bit of an anti-pattern. It's a bit of a, you don't really want to have a DevOps team. A lot of people will say that just creates a third silo between Dev and Ops.
Yes, yes.
But it's a good way to start. And I've seen this at work in a lot of large enterprises, starting with a DevOps team that does second people from development, QA, security, production and operations, even people like PMO, finance, HR. Individuals, get them together in a room, even if it's a virtual room, get them working together. And understand each other's process, understand each other's needs, and figure out, well, what do I do that hurts someone else's ability to deliver? What can I do better that will make their ability to deliver even better? So from a security perspective, for example, having security and security admins in the room when you're planning your release, that's a really strong part of it. It's about people communicating. But then you can do things around, as Monzi was saying, things around automation, automated testing, automated penetration testing, automated vulnerability scanning. That fits in with the mantra around the technology of DevOps, which is very much focused on automation.
Specs in our chat room brings up a very good point, which is you're going to need good chemistry between these people, because in a lot of organizations, the people you bring into that room are competing with each other for resources.
Yeah.
No, we need more resources because we need to make it more secure. And they're saying, no, we need more resources because no one's going to use a secure but unusable UI. Let's go really concrete on this. You've got a meeting space for the start, the very start of the development of a new product. Who comes into that room? Let's say you've got five slots. who are the people that you pull in to actually start mapping out how the timeline of the project is going to look? Because you're going to need security people in there. You're going to need ops people. For you, what would be the perfect five-person mix?
Perfect five-person mix for me would be PMO, development, operations, QA, and security.
Okay, you had that answer way too fast. So you've been thinking about this.
I have thought about this a lot. Okay. I've actually done this work a lot with customers as well. Actually going out, this is my title as an advocate. I go out to my customer, I advocate how can they do this sort of stuff much, much, much beyond just using Splunk as their technology. Very much about how do they communicate with each other? How do they set up these rooms? How do they start this tiger team? How do they then deploy these people out into their own organizations to get that coordination and collaboration going? And honestly, it starts even before that in my mind. It starts with getting together in a way to get to know each other. Go and play some paintball or play some LAN games, but be in a room together.
Right.
Don't play versus, by the way. Play co-op. these sorts of things are really fundamental to get to know each other. Do lunch and learns. Do a 5-minute, do a pizza session at lunchtime where you actually explain your job to other people who may not have any clue what you do. You know, as an operator back in my deep dark past, I didn't necessarily know what a security team did. And so just to have them come and tell me what they do as a job makes me think, well, what can I do to be better at what I do and make their life easier as well? So it's even more, it's about sharing information, about sharing ideas, collaborating with each other.
Oh, by the way, we've got JJ to the 4884 who is inviting you to, he says you should do a B-sides presentation, just FYI. Monzi, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to, on the concrete step piece, one of the things that I learned and, you know, from primarily through collaboration and colleagues, and one person shared a very interesting story with me. He said, you know, what we did was we said, all right, imagine that you had a service outage that was business significant of some kind. And then imagine who would you call in that room in order to resolve that service outage so the customers can get back online and you can continue business. And those are the kinds of – those same people can be the people who are invited ahead of time when a new product or when a new service is being developed. Because when you look at this from an incident response perspective, then you might look at this and say, you know what? I wish I had talked to security. Call the security guy in here. Call the developer person in here. Call the person who's responsible for service delivery and for uptime in the room. And those are the people that we end up calling into a war room when things hit the fan. And if that's the case, then we already know who to call. And let's start calling each other ahead of time. And I think there's also a little bit of a social change that we all have to work towards for ourselves, whether we're in IT or ops or whether we're developers or whether we're security teams, is we're all there for the user. We're all there for the customer, and no one needs to be reminded of that. We're all very passionate about it, which is why we work strange hours and work day in and day out. Everybody, regardless of the silo that we belong to, regardless of the badge and the organizational structure that we report into, that's our goal. And so I think if we just put on that hat for a moment and say, you know, how can I serve my customer best? Or how can I serve my user best? That's when I think we can all come together easily and say, you know what, let's make that the success factor for ourselves. And that's where I think in a very tactical way, we can share information, we can work on the problem, and we can protect ourselves from some adversity that might happen in the future. And to Andy's point, if we are doing that in that spirit, then when something does go wrong, it's not the first time when you're having an interaction with somebody. They understand how you behave, they understand who you are, they know what you do and what you care about, and that makes life go faster, in a much smoother way.
I love that paradigm. I think that's so much easier to understand than saying, okay, rugged DevOps is a hybrid of blah, blah. Just say, okay, let's go through a couple of scenarios. Something that happens to a product. Who do you want in that escape room? Who are the personnel who need to be at a discussion of X, this, that, that? And if you do it that way, I think people, they it's easier to break down the silos because they now have a goal. They have a goal of fixing the breach or fixing an exfil issue. And actually, let me bring my co-host back on this. Curtis, what about that? What about that escape room? I mean, obviously, Andy has put a lot of thought into who are the five perfect people to have in the escape room at the beginning. But do you think it's easier to convince an executive that DevOps and secure DevOps is a necessity if you can explain it in terms of who do we call when the S hits the fan?
I think that from the executive buy-in, it really does help. And one of the things that we hear an awful lot in the somewhat related topic of agile development is that it works best if the entire organization embraces agile discipline rather than having it simply be something for the IT group. And I think there's a bit of that that works with DevOps as well. It's really a philosophy of communication and shared responsibility that works best in an overall corporate environment of communication and shared responsibility. It's interesting. One of the key things that I have found in talking to a lot of executives over the years is that they're very busy people. It's kind of like something that the comedian Bill Cosby used to say in his routine, that parents don't care about justice. Parents care about quiet. There are many regards in which executives don't care about discipline. They care about results that don't require them to do extra work. And so if you can tell them that by having this individual as part of the DevOps team, that it means one fewer phone call, that if you do it this way, it provides, in the words of a phrase that I hate a lot, one throat to choke if something goes wrong, then I think that for better or for worse, you do have a much more compelling argument to be made than one in which you get very theoretical about what your framework means for each piece of the puzzle.
So that's sort of the Darth Vader approach to being an exec. It's just one throat to choke.
Absolutely.
I like that. Okay.
What would Darth do?
We could put that on a t-shirt too, I guess. All right. Andy, I want to go back to you because I know that Splunk has actually just announced new versions of some of your tools, IT security, IT monitoring, that has these issues in mind. So dovetailing on what Curtis just said about the one throat to choke, how can Splunk help me find that one person? How does Splunk help that one person make sure that he or she has all the information that they need to help create that rugged DevOps team?
Yeah, well, Splunk is collecting all the data from all of the tool sets that are created in the delivery pipeline. So you start with the project management stuff. So what stories are being worked on? Who's working on them? Even down to things like how much is the estimated cost for that story? Then take it through the whole dev lifecycle. What code is being checked out, checked in? Who's working on different stories? Who's working on different releases? Through the QA process, getting the data out of the QA systems, correlating it, aggregating it, figuring out whether your security testing is right, your pen testing is right, the quality testing, understanding, running your automated security tests and getting all that data into Splunk, getting the release data, the provisioning, the configuration, the integration of the code, and then releasing it into production, and then correlating production performance and security events back to individual code releases, individual release items, individual developers even. And then so having all of that data available to everyone who uses that tool chain, that's a really powerful start. Then when it's in production, having everyone available to use that data to do triage and response. So when you have a security event, being able to see, everyone can see, the development team can see that event, operations obviously, but the security team can see that event in real time as well. With Splunk, you're sharing the common data fabric. So every stakeholder in that application delivery lifecycle can see at every stage what's coming, what's being released, what's happening in production, and what do I need to do to fix it?
Manzi, what about that? So how does that tool help you? So as the security researcher, as the advocate for security first, for finding the flaws, for making sure that we're not releasing any product into the wild that's going to have incredibly detrimental effects on everything, how does that tool, the Splunk monitoring tool, let you make more informed decisions?
I like to use as a very concrete example of a log line. Let's think about an Apache log line, and let's say it has an IP address, it has a status code, perhaps it has a URL, and so the question is, well, whose data is that? Does that belong to the IT team? Does that belong to the developer team? Does that belong to the security team? And who can take, you know, or does it belong to finance? Who can make the take the best advantage of that information? And the answer is all of the above. I mean, imagine if that log line came from a shopping cart transaction. And the IT team can look at that and say, you know what, our average transaction rate times are pretty good, so we're within our boundaries. Security team can look at it and say, well, you're transacting business with a, you know, with a from a certain geographical location or from a certain kind of browser because there's a user agent string in there, or from or with a certain type of bite-sized transaction because that's what's important. Finance can look at that and say, you know what, we're selling more flowers this time of the year. I wonder what's going on. Maybe we need to boost up inventory, which goes to the business analytics guys. And the developers keep looking at them going, well, how come we have this surge of iOS devices all of a sudden who are interested in buying flowers? Maybe we need to take a look at what the UI looks like. So I think the way this helps all of the different teams, to Andy's point, is this data, this needs to be democratized in many ways to the right people who need to take a look at it at the right time so that they can make the appropriate contribution. And so for security is the same thing. And, you know, maybe to go on my bandwagon for a little bit, I used to be a Splunk customer before I was a Splunk employee. And I you know, for the lack of a better expression, literally bribed people to put their data into Splunk by offering them Splunk as a tool for which they did not have to pay for or did not have to invest any energy in standing up. And as a security guy, when everybody else took advantage of Splunk, all of a sudden I had access to the data that they were collecting. And so instead of going to them and saying, hey, Mr. Active Directory person, can you please, please, please give me some AD logs so I can try to work this problem out? Now all of a sudden people are voluntarily placing their data inside of Splunk. And so now it's democratizing the access and the analytics. And I saw you roll down, you know, the press release thing. And on this point of democratization, we've, as a company, have continued to do that by, from learning from our customers, not just for things that we used to do, but now things that we're going to do into the future, like applying machine learning. And I know it's kind of a little bit of a buzzword, but it's not about the buzzword itself or about all the sexy or the hotness. It's about what is it that you're going to do with it? And how do we make these things easier, making the more sophisticated analytics easier? And so, you know, as a security guy, that's great. The more people bring their data into Splunk, the easier their lives become, the easier my life becomes as a blue teamer to analyze and to defend and respond and to get a handle on what's happening.
Lou, you are actually doing this right now in the real world for a real world project. And I don't know how much you can reveal to us, but how does this ring in your world? We've been talking about breaking down silos. We've been talking about actually looking at the teams that you would gather to handle certain issues. How much of this rugged DevOps strategy should be implemented by a team that's actually going to be releasing within a couple of months?
It's being etched into our DNA at this point. I think, you know, as a cloud service, you have to bring everybody with you at this point. I think Curtis kind of pointed it out. He said, you know, you have to have these relationships and everyone has to be agile in order for you to handle this. And one thing we've been doing, and this is a big thing, is we've been consolidating. You know, we're moving kind of the, you know, the discrete roles that were there before around program management and feature teams. And the feature teams kind of made up of program management, developers, testers. And then you had kind of the ops on the side and then, you know, that kind of thing. And what we're doing now is we're merging. So now everyone's a developer and you have some managers, project managers around that, and those have really become your, what we call your feature team, and we've consolidated that. And then, you know, the ops have become part of that team, and we have this complete life cycle feedback loop that we've got done where now we deploy a feature and all that data kind of flows in, whether what customers are doing, how they're using it, whether they're running into a problem, and that flows directly to our ops team. And we could create automatic cases for them. We can, which then get either deployed to them, they go fix an infrastructure problem, or down to us as a bug, we do an RC on that bug, we fix it, we redeploy it, we close the case. The ops team deploys that fix, and boom, the customer has it before they know it, and they never knew anything happened. And that's kind of the way of the world. I think that's just where companies are moving, and they need to move to be agile and to kind of stay with the world. And that's where DevOps kind of comes in. It's just really powerful to bring that synergy across all these disciplines and really kind of get yourself moving and be very have the ability to kind of move in a more agile, fantastic. And that's how we operate internally here. I mean, we're constantly moving that way.
I love that.
I want to piggyback on what Lou was saying. I mean, it's exciting to hear him sort of validate some of these things. I mean, when the customers that I speak with, they're always talking about being analytics driven in terms of how they operate. And they're always talking to me about saying, you know, what I really need and when I succeed, I want to have this nerve center where instead of taking this silo approach, I want to take a nerve center approach. I want to have a nerve center where all the different pieces can plug in, just like that animation that we just saw, and people can sort of move information back and forth, and the action can move back and forth. So different parts of the teams and different parts of whoever is involved in that can actually take action and contribute to the effort in a seamless way.
Well, I'm hoping that if our audience walks away with anything from the show, it's that they have a better idea of what it means to have rugged DevOps. You know, that's DevSecOps. This is the story. This is the thing that people need to understand. They need to know why it's there. It needs to be more than just another buzzword. And I think we've done a pretty good job. I will say we're running over time. We ran out of time, but we want to hear the Splunk case stories because you've got some great ones. I want to give Andy Munsey an ability to say what's coming next in 2017. We're at the start of this new year. I understand Splunk has a few exciting things in the pipeline. Could you tease our audience so that they know what they're in for the next time you come back on Twiit?
Look, I'll just start by letting you know that we released in January about a week ago. Our module for IT service intelligence, which monitors and manages the continuous delivery cycle from planning all the way through to delivery. So taking those inputs from multiple data streams in the tool chain and surfacing those as a service. So looking at the application delivery lifecycle as a service. We released an MVP for that. So you can probably guess that we're going to keep building on that kind of capability through the year. Can't go too much into roadmaps, public company,
of course,
et cetera, et cetera. But there is some very exciting things to come around DevOps and around the DevSecOps, the rugged DevOps stuff.
Oh, fantastic. And Munsey, any last words from you?
I would say that our biggest focus from a security perspective, which is really intertwined with the IT side of the house and dev side of the house, is really around focusing on that nerve center approach to make it easier for people to collaborate, make it easy for organizations to make the best use of data that we have. You know, we have a big RSA conference coming up, which is a big day for security. We have some big announcements to make there. If you're in the San Francisco area, I mean, you can even get some free passes to RSA through the Splunk website. Come on down, take a look. We have a lot of exciting stuff, and it's all really just focused on this notion of we need a nerve center. We need to democratize analytics and more work together as a unit.
And am I far off in saying that if they do come visit you on the campus, that they can probably get one of the famous Splunk T-shirts?
Almost definitely. We have a whole range. I'd be personally happy to give out a couple.
I have a few special ones that Wildman had printed up that we were told we shouldn't wear those in public, but they're great shirts, great slogans. So that's fantastic. Gentlemen, thank you so very much for coming on. I got to give you your plug time, and you're both going to get your own time. So Andy, anything you want to talk about, any place that you want to tell our audience to go, anything about Splunk you want to say, take it away.
Absolutely. So firstly, have a look at splunk.com/DevOps. Whole bunch of there's case studies there, what you were talking about before. We've got stories up there from a bunch of our customers telling about how they use Splunk for DevOps. Check me at Andy Mann, at Andy Mann. You can see that on screen. Also at Splunk. Follow them. All sorts of news from them.
Fantastic. And Munsey, what about you? I mean, of course, you've got a very specific focus at Splunk. Where would you like people to go to find more of your work and more of your work at Splunk?
So the best place to go is to really go to the Splunk blog page. A lot of the work that my team does on the research side of the house is posted there. I also encourage you guys, if you haven't already downloaded Splunk, go to splunk.com and download it. I know we're joking about T-shirts, and you know we say we're a T-shirt company with a download. And so go do that. And and also, I want you all to Google Splunk Adaptive Response and see where that leads you. I look forward to seeing many of you at RSA. If not, I'll see you on Twitter at Munsey Mirza. Thanks for having me on the show.
We've been speaking with Munsey Mirza, the head of cyber research at Splunk, and Andy Mann, the chief technology advocate at Splunk. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I hope we can have you back at some point in the near future, because again, we didn't get through half of your material because we're just having so much fun talking about DevOps.
Oh, look, thanks, Padre. I would love to come back. Thank you very much for having us.
Fantastic. And of course, folks, you have done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 log entries. I want to thank my co-hosts for being here. Of course, I wouldn't want to do Twight without them. Starting, of course, with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, it's come to Twit time. You teased us at the beginning that you had some sort of announcement, some sort of thing that you wanted to share with the Twight, right? Now is the time to do that.
Well, Padre, I'm happy to do so. Now, my lower third this time reads freelance journalist. Next time, it's going to read something different because I have taken a position with a longstanding site called Light Reading. I am the security editor for Light Reading and will also be heading up a new site that will be going out under the Light Reading umbrella very soon. Be happy to talk about that. But the great news is that I'll be coming to shows like RSA. Look forward to seeing Andy and everybody else at Splunk while I'm out there. And looking forward to bringing a lot of great articles about how people in the real world are adapting to the security challenges that we've all been hit with.
Thank you very much. That's Curtis Franklin, of course. He joins us. Well, I don't even know what our schedule is yet. Chiebert's the only guy who really understands who comes on the show when. He is really the mastermind behind Twight, and that's why we love him so much. But Curtis, whenever you come on, I get filled with hope for the future, except for the fact that you live in Florida, which is weird. But okay. Someone who doesn't live in Florida and who I'm told is actually standing right now and drinking like 15 gallons of water a day because it's his New Year resolution. It's Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, what's going on with you?
Absolutely. I keep my energy up every day, and now I can actually not fall asleep by the end of the day. But yeah, doing lots of things here and really exciting stuff coming soon. Lots of new events coming this spring. So keep an eye out on in the CRM world. We're going to bring some really fun stuff coming soon. And of course, you can always check me out at twitter.com/LouMM.
Gentlemen, thank you so very much. And also thank you to you, to the person who comes back each and every week to get your dose of enterprise goodness. We couldn't have the show without you, and you've been loyal listeners and viewers for, what are we? We're going into year four, year five? I've lost track. That's how long we've been doing the show. We want to make it easier for you to get all of the Twight goodness that you can handle, and you can do that by going to our show page at twit.tv/Twight. Once you're there, you'll find all of our back episodes. And more importantly, you'll find the subscribe drop-down menus. You can get the version of your choice into the device of your choice. You can get an audio version in your phone so you can listen to us on the way to work. You could get a video version on your tablet so that you can watch us on your break. Or you could download the high definition version so that you can watch us on your TV when you get home. Because, you know, I've heard that there's really nothing better than curling up on a cold night in front of a fire and listening to Curtis, Chiebert, myself, and Lou talk about enterprise stuff. That's, all at twit.tv/Twight. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter. Just go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll see not just what we're going to be doing on Twight, but you'll also see what I do on the other Twit shows and even outside of Twit. Yes, I do actually have a life outside of Twit, and most of it involves making things. Again, PadreSJ. That's twitter.com/PadreSJ. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who let us continue to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, to my super producer, Brian Chi, to all of our engineers, and a special guest today. Kara, I don't know if you've got a microphone on yourself, but
I do.
You do. If you could tell the folks what it is that you actually do here at the studio, because I'm really unclear about that.
Oh, you know, usually I engineer all kinds of things. What does that mean? I don't know. Set up cameras, set up lights, that kind of good stuff. I do camera operating in the field. We went to CES recently. That was a lot of fun. And I'm a producer on our show, The New Screensavers. You catch that on Saturdays at 3.
But of course, Kara's primary job is to sit next to Burke and to annoy him as much as possible. And to that, I salute you, Kara. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.